It's 5:06. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, in for Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up a little later in the show, a look at long-term unemployment benefits and the new federal budget deal. And we'll talk to a guest who says cash is becoming obsolete and credit cards may follow pretty soon.
But now, a look at the state's searchable online circuit court database, also known as CCAP. It's used by human resources professionals and many members of the public who want to search the criminal histories of the people of Wisconsin.
In recent years, the merits of the online database have been debated. Ultimately, the site remains accessible to everybody. Nearly all criminal charges are visible to users.
According to our next guest, the open accessibility leads to misuse of information and even discrimination. Joel McNally is a journalist and adjunct lecturer at UW-Milwaukee. He recently wrote an article in Milwaukee Shepherd Express called CCAP's Criminal Records Are the Official State Blacklist. Joel, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Gene. Glad to be on.
I want to start with talking about your role as a journalist, because that's how you open up your piece, your lead. Because, you know, as a journalist, the idea of having a searchable database like this is a wonderful thing. And the idea that public records are public is something that is almost an absolute.
Absolutely. Although I do know, too, that over the years, journalism itself has censored itself. And censored public records. A long time ago, we stopped running addresses of in obituaries because we heard, and I don't even know, it could have just been anecdotal, but heard that people would be going off to their funerals and their homes would be burglarized because everyone the burglars used them as like a shopping list. And we're always, balancing the use of information versus the damage that it can do. And I think in the case of CCAP, the damage is really pretty obvious.
And let's talk about that, because the concept of, let's talk about the concept of CCAP first, and then have you talk about how you see the reality of it.
Okay. what's the concept?
Well,
the
you
concept
tell me.
Is,
I mean, the concept.
The concept is everything in the world is there,
and
actually that's part of the basic problem, because not only are there criminal convictions on there and misdemeanor convictions, but there are even charges that someone was never convicted of, charges that ultimately were dropped, charges that never went to trial, basically an arrest. We know by now that an arrest is not a conviction, and that an arrest doesn't prove anything, and you're supposed to be innocent until you're proven guilty. But you can say, and you can even mark that on the public record that this was dismissed or this charge ended in acquittal. But believe me, if an employer is looking at that list and they see someone was arrested for anything, whether they were convicted or not, they're looking for reasons to, throw people out of, if people have applied for jobs and they got, a ton more applications than anybody they can hire, they're just looking for reasons to get rid of people. And we know that, most of the public, considers an arrest a conviction. We know that just from just from the gossip, just from the assumption that if a charge shows up in the newspaper, everyone figures, they must have done something, or the police wouldn't have charged him.
CCAP's been around for a while, and
it sure has.
But I was trying to think how long it's been, 10 or 15, or at least 15 years, I would say.
I'd say more than that. It's been around for, who knows when the whole computer age took over, but journalists have always been able to search records. People who have a legitimate interest have always had an ability to search records. We don't want government to be withholding these records. At the same time, just to put it out the way that it's put out, and I think it should be a dead giveaway that 8 million visitors a year to this site. I mean, that's practically porn site access. I can't think of any other records in state government that would draw millions of people And we know that a lot of it is, you know, some of it may just be prurient interest or looking up your neighbors or whatever. But I don't think a whole lot of people in this state realize that the state of Wisconsin is basically publicizing, you know, any contact they may have ever had with law enforcement, and that that could be, in fact, used illegitimately against them.
And so how do you know this is happening? I mean, is this all anecdotal or just your observations, or do you have some data to back it up?
Well, what do you mean by that?
I mean, do you have numbers? Can you prove it? Can you attribute it to somebody?
No. You say, yeah, I'm a journalist. Do I have to attribute something to somebody? No. I think it is fairly common knowledge that employers check it, that landlords check it, and they use it as a basis for determining whether someone can rent an apartment or get a job. You know, those 8 million people, you know, that is a whole lot of people looking into the very private, embarrassing personal records of individuals. Now, yeah, they allowed to because it's a public record, but you know, it is. Here's the interesting thing: you know, you couldn't get an employer to tell you that they had checked this and decided not to offer someone a job because they found a conviction on this site.
Yeah, there's this little thing you're supposed to click.
Because a matter of fact, it is against the law. It is against the law in the state of Wisconsin to discriminate in hiring on the basis of a criminal record. And then you put all the criminal records out there and say, you know, well, here's all the criminal records, but of course, you know, if you check these and you discriminate against somebody, that would be bad. But you know, have a field day. So I can't document how many people who may have been, you know, may have been convicted of something a long time ago, or you know, may have legitimately done something, you know, pretty bad in the past, and that it's been held against them their entire life. But I think it makes common sense that. Yeah, if employers are checking this and deciding, you know, on hiring on the basis of what they see there, even though it's against the law in many cases, that is very damaging. It's not only damaging to the individuals; it's damaging to the communities, because you want people who, in fact, have criminal convictions and have served time in prison. If they're returning to their communities, you want them to be able to get legitimate employment. You don't want them to be discriminated against because of those convictions, because if they can't, in fact, support themselves legitimately, that, you know, is an open invitation to go back to crime and to continue to criminalize, you know, commit crimes in the community and victimize other members of the community. It is in everyone's public interest not to discriminate against those people, even though this particular form of record, which is, you know, practically, you know, a website with neon, you know, going off around it, you know, like some of those, you know, things you see on the internet that claim you won $1 million. You know, you've got these state records that are being treated just for everyone's prurient interest, and 8 million people a year are very interested, and not all of them are going to be using those records, you know, for some legitimate purpose.
So where's the balance here? I mean, how do you protect the rights of individuals who may have been mm-hmm. charged with something years ago and it was dismissed, with the public's right to know what government is up to?
Mm-hmm. Well, there have been many suggestions over the years. I mean, one obvious is that there should at least be a time limit on when something's on there. The other, which I think should just almost go without saying, is that there should not be things on there that are not proven. If someone has been charged with something but have been convicted of nothing, I don't think that should, you know, be available, because people are you know, are seeing something that we haven't even judged the truth of yet or not. So, you know, over the years, various legislators have said, you know, we recognize that this is damaging. We recognize that there are unintended consequences to this that are very bad for the communities. And as a result, you know, there should be it shouldn't be used like a blacklist. It shouldn't be used, you know, just to automatically prevent employment of people who need employment in this economy. In order to support their families and support their community and participate in the, you know, return to their communities, return to legitimate employment, and straighten up. I mean, for the same reason that, in fact, you know, those people should be allowed to vote when they return to the communities. We want them to work legitimately. We want them to care about their communities. We want them to be involved in their community and instead of, you know, whatever their lives may have been before. And instead, the state right now is enabling people to violate the law, basically, and to discriminate.
All right, we're talking with Joel McNally about his recent article, CCAP's Criminal Records Are the Official State Blacklist. It appeared in Milwaukee Shepherd Express.
And we want to know what you think about this. Should these records, these court records of criminal charges and convictions, be available to anyone who wants to go online and look at them? Have you used CCAP to look someone up, a potential employee, potential tenant, potential date? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email, talk@WPR.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We're talking with columnist Joel McNally about his recent op-ed called CCAP Criminal Records Are the Official State Blacklist. And we're taking your calls on CCAP right now. If you've had an experience with CCAP, if you've been CCAP yourself, or if you've seen charges that were filed against you, never convicted of, but now they've lurking there year after year after year, give us a call at 800-642-1234. Our email is talk@WPR.org. Let's go to the phones, and we begin with Jeff, who joins us from Appleton. Hi, Jeff.
Hi there. The information should be available, but the problem with it being available on the Internet is simply the anonymity. Back in the infancy of CCAP, I did witness groups of people sitting in the office and pulling up random people throughout the office. Saw it happen. But the information should be available to somebody who has the gumption to walk into a building and request it face-to-face.
All right, Jeff, thanks for that. And Joel McNally, there you go. Go back to the 20th century, just walk into a building and ask for a record. How's that sound?
Yeah, imagine that. You know, we did used to do those sorts of things, didn't we? At the very least, to me, that would mean that the people who are going to the trouble of doing it, you know, we know that government can sometimes on its own set up hoops that you have to jump through because they don't want you to get something. In this particular case, I think just the fact that it takes a little energy and a little effort on your part to get it. Like I say, government should never be allowed to hide this stuff, but we don't have to put it out, you know, the way that this is put out, where at the click of a button you can review somebody's whole life. The truth of the matter is, all of us did things sometime in our life that we wouldn't like to see passed around the office. Like,
you'll notice I'm being very quiet right now. I'm not saying anything.
Yeah, I mean, some of the people who actually have even argued against some of these attempts to limit the list or to make it not quite so accessible. They say, well, you know, if employers really want this, and if landlords really want this, there's going to be some private service which is going to pop up for a fee to get this list for employers or for landlords or other interested people, and that they may not be as accurate as even these records are. These, at least, you know, they're official records, so you know that they're there. But we don't know if some private service would, you know, some PI, you know, making money on the side by going through these records would be as careful as somebody else. Now, I can understand that argument. At the same time, you know, to me, what Jeff described is everyone's nightmare, right? I mean, that you know, people will be sitting around an office and calling up their friends' names and their neighbors and their girlfriends and I don't think people realize in this state that the state of Wisconsin is actually, you know, making that possible, enabling that really, and kind of saying go to it.
Let's follow up on that with a call. David joins us now from Milwaukee. Hi, David.
Hello. This is a great show and very needed. I am, I hate to say the word victim, but my situation was this. In the past, I had a drug problem, but for 12 years, I cleaned it up and I changed my life. And I am totally blacklisted. That word blacklisted from employment is perfect. I've had jobs offered to me, and then all of a sudden, just before I was going to take them, I'd get a call back with an excuse of, you know, nothing to do with the record, of why I couldn't get the job. And this has happened at least 10, 20 times to me. I went to MATC just recently for a welding diploma. I did well in it. And they said there's welding jobs. I couldn't get a job because of this situation. And it's heartbreaking. I mean, I'm 59 years old, and, you know, I can't even explain what this, how this makes people like me feel. And my other thing I wanted to say is if there's an organization that's working to try to do something about this, I would try to like to be in contact with those people so I could help maybe move this issue forward.
David, thanks so much for the call. Joel McNally, are there efforts to change what you can see on CCAP? I know this has come up in the legislature a few times. I think there's some legislation pending right now, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, I think right now, the one that's pending right now is kind of goofy, kind of silly. It seems to be aimed at, it's a Republican bill, and it's introduced by some folks who say, well, what we really have to take off of there are financial judgments after a certain period of time in civil suits. It appears to be more concerned about white-collar constituents of certain Republican legislators than about this real problem, and the really horrible problem that David described. I mean, we talked about the, you know, passing, you know, frivolous stuff around the office about people's past. But what happened to David, and what has happened to people like him? I mean, imagine this: someone who has done the right thing, you know, if they did any time at all, but maybe not. Maybe they got into some rehab as a result of a contact with law enforcement. They cleaned themselves up. They are doing exactly what we want them to do in this society, and by doing it, you know, they end up, you know, unemployable, or end up having it held against them the rest of their lives. They're not who they were, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. They're someone else entirely, but, you know, they can't prove it to anybody because no one will even, you know, you're lucky to get called in for an interview because you could be completely dismissed before you ever got to that point to be able to explain who you are today. And that's terrible. I do know that some of the Milwaukee Democratic legislators, Fred Kessler for sure, and Mandela Barnes, and some of them have been introducing some things to try to have a time limit on some of these records. Those two legislators' names immediately come to mind. I don't know an organization particularly, although there are some good organizations working to try to overcome some of the obstacles from people who, you know, when they're released back into the community, Project Return and some others. So there are some organizations around I know who are concerned. ACLU is always very concerned about information being misused. So, you know, those are just a couple ideas. But I think this David's story is really the point. That it, you know, we don't want people who are convicted of crimes. You know, we talked about the fact that some people could be blacklisted.
And Joel McNally, I'm afraid we've got to go. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah,
well,
we're out of time.
I sure appreciate it, Gene.
And we appreciate your time. Thanks for being with us. That was Joel McNally, journalist and adjunct lecturer at UW-Milwaukee. He recently wrote an article in Milwaukee's Shepherd Express called CCAP's Criminal Records Are the Official State Blacklist. And you can read it for yourself on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up, we'll find out what the proposed federal budget deal means for long-term unemployment benefits here in Wisconsin. That's coming up after the news. Stick around, there's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. On the day after a budget deal was reached in Washington, the Obama administration announced that nearly 100,000 Wisconsinites could lose access to long-term unemployment benefits unless Congress takes action.
And Congress has expressed some concerns about extending the program. So what does this mean for unemployed workers here in Wisconsin?
Joining us now is Laura Dresser, Associate Director of the Center on Wisconsin Strategy. Laura, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what does it take for someone to qualify for the extended unemployment benefits? How long do they go? When do they kick in?
Well, the extended unemployment benefits program started in 2008 under George Bush. And it happens basically every time we have an economic meltdown when unemployment rates go up and people end up unemployed for a long time. First, they use up their state benefits, and then they usually, the federal government has an extended program that adds on the extra weeks of unemployment benefits. There's different tiers depending on your state's unemployment rate, how many extra benefits you qualify for, and Wisconsin actually just moved from the maximum tier into a kind of middle tier. But workers that hit the end of their benefits December 28th in Wisconsin, and there's about 24,000 of those workers, would not qualify for the 14 more weeks of benefits that they would qualify for otherwise if they do extend this.
And then others later on, not at that December 28th deadline?
Right, because other workers will hit the end of their state benefits later, and so that's when they would be picking up the federal benefit. Anyway, so that number across the next next 2 years would be 100,000 workers who didn't get extended benefits, but the December 28th number is about 24,000.
And you mentioned these benefits have been in place since George W. Bush signed them in 2008. They've been extended a bunch of times since, but this was supposed to be a temporary measure, right? Is the economy recovering enough to where we're ready to not keep renewing these?
Well, this is the problem or the elusive nature of this recovery. What we have in this recovery, we still have fewer jobs, just barely getting back to the level of employment we had in 2007. We have more workers in this labor market than we did then. This has been a very, very weak recovery. And so, yes, it's supposed to be a temporary benefit, but it's supposed to be a benefit as long as unemployment rates are high, and especially as long as long-term unemployment rates are high. And that's where we've seen the real increases. There's about twice as much long-term unemployment as there was before the recession. Those folks really need these benefits to make ends meet. And the economy really needs that money coming in and reinforcing in such a weak recovery. We need money coming in, and unemployment and benefits is one way for that to happen.
Two things I want to follow up on there. First of all, this chronic long-term unemployment. People have been writing a lot about that having been unemployed for a long time makes it harder to get a job. Companies are actually first clearing out resumes of people who are currently unemployed. Is this a new, tougher version of long-term unemployment?
Well, long-term unemployment is really difficult in the way you just say. The longer you're out of the labor market, the harder it is to get back in. The more employers, just use the unemployment as a sorting mechanism. Also, it's worth remembering that the unemployment is not kind of spread equally across the population. It's hit in specific economies where there have been massive shutdowns. So even in the state of Wisconsin, we have communities with very high unemployment. And so the extended benefits help those communities where workers are really struggling to find jobs. And in the background, remembering that we have fewer jobs today than we did 5 years ago, is another reason people are struggling to find jobs, but have been for a long time. But yes, you're exactly right that when people come into that long-term situation, it just gets harder and harder to get out.
And then the other thing I wanted to follow up on, you mentioned briefly the economic benefit overall nationwide and maybe in those hard-hit communities you mentioned. How important are these unemployment checks in keeping local and then the national economy growing?
Well, this is a critical aspect of federal stimulus. And in fact, because the national conversation is so focused on deficit reduction, this is one of the few places that unemployment insurance works countercyclically. That is, money comes into pockets that need the money, that don't have the money when times are tight and when jobs are gone. And so this is directed to the very communities that need it most, the very households who have faced the hardest time in this economy, and it gets spent in those local communities, whether it's on rent or heat or food, and so it ripples through our economy in an effective way. An important stimulus to this still too weak recovery.
So the reason we're talking about this today is the deal reached yesterday by Congressman Ryan and Senator Murray. A lot of Democrats had been very hopeful that an unemployment benefit extension was going to be part of this deal. Some said it would be a non-starter if it wasn't part of it. Hey, were you hopeful that these unemployment benefits would be extended, or were you not surprised by what happened?
I guess I didn't know well enough the inside game to know whether I should be hopeful or not. But I do know that it's a disappointment. That the deal was made between Murray and Ryan on improving what was, supposed to be unpalatable, the sequester. That they found a way to improve that, I think, is good. But that they have left out unemployment, the long-term unemployed, is a real shame. And I hope something that the Congress manages to fix before they go home for their holidays in their warm homes.
In a sense, unemployment benefits, short or long term, are kind of a Band-Aid here for the problem of unemployment. Do you see other success stories in getting people back to work and off of these benefits so that they don't need them in the first place?
Well, the real question, I think, in terms of these benefits is about the health of the overall economy, not the kind of the individual situation so much as the general demand. What we need to see is stronger economic growth and the production of more jobs that will shorten the long lines that line up at every open job that exists and allow employers the ability to just be throwing out, resumes on the basis of how long folks have been unemployed. So what we really need is a lot more jobs, not so much specific training programs at this point, although training matters. But, in the context of this very weak demand, what we really need is some demand both on the private and public side to increase the number of jobs so that more and more people can get back to work.
And again, I know you don't have the inside scoop on what people in Congress are thinking, but do you think there's a shot that even though it's not in this budget deal, the White House and Congress might still do something to extend the longer term unemployment benefits?
I know there are a lot of people inside and outside the Congress working on that issue, and there are a lot of there will be a lot of efforts around it, but I guess I will just have to keep my fingers crossed.
Laura, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Laura Dresser. She's Associate Director of the Center on Wisconsin Strategy.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. According to our next guest, the future of money has arrived, and it might not be what we're used to. He points out that cash is increasingly becoming obsolete, and if new technologies catch on, credit cards could soon follow suit.
Joining us now is Matt Vasiligambros. He is a staff correspondent at the National Journal. Matt, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
I want to start out with this whole cash is dead concept. Is that something that's happening all over the country? I mean, I still see plenty of it around.
Yeah, it's a concept that we're starting to see more and more in research. The people I talk to, it's a Chicago-based public relations firm called Walker Sands. They say that nearly 1 in 5 consumers don't even carry cash on them anymore, and a further 60% of consumers carry less than $20 in their pocket. And so they're seeing this trend of people not carrying cash in their pockets anymore and maybe relying more on credit cards or the technology that I talked about in this piece.
Yeah, and I want to get to that technology because I got to tell you, little insight here. I was so proud of myself when we were going to talk about the coin because I knew exactly what the Bitcoin was, and I was going to. But it's not the same thing at all. The coin is a totally different concept. So why don't you explain it for our listeners?
Sure. The coin, ironically enough, the future of money, as I call it. But the coin, it looks like a credit card. It's the size of a credit card. It swipes like a credit card, but it holds all the information of up to 8 different credit cards. And if you simply press a button on this little plastic piece and it switches between your debit card or your credit card or your card for business, and it works just the same. And it's a product that only costs right now $50 or $100 when it comes out next summer. And they're promising that this will change fundamentally the way things work and that you will only have to carry this one simple thing in your pocket instead of all the credit cards and cash and everything. And it's a really interesting concept to me.
It is an interesting concept because you could take all your various credit cards, your Discover, your Visa, your Amex, whatever, your debit card, I assume, could be on there and
Absolutely.
All those things.
Yep.
And I like that. I sure like that flexibility, mm-hmm. but I don't like the part where I set something down and I walk away from it. And there's my 25 credit cards all sitting there far away from me, and I'm never going to see them again.
Except, though, there is the only reason this works is there's a little Bluetooth technology, and every time that you walk away from your credit card, say you leave it at your coin, and you leave it at the restaurant, your phone will get a notification. It'll buzz, and it'll say, hey, you left your card. You know, you're far away from your coin right now, so you can walk back and go get it. The problem, though, is if your phone is off, you don't get that notification. And, it's still just as risky in terms of all your information on one thing as a regular plastic card. And I think lest we forget that credit cards aren't necessarily a really tough concept, you know, to begin with. It's not really an inconvenience to carry a few credit cards in your wallet. So it's one of those old adages that, they're creating a solution for something that wasn't really a problem.
But it's a solution, you know, really, given the right zeitgeist and everything, it could really just catch on.
It really could. And I think we're seeing through different startups, whether you're talking about PayPal or the Google Wallet. There are several different digital startups, so these little companies of a few techies who have created this really revolutionary out there concept that are starting to catch on. And you can pay digitally now. You can just hit your phone somewhere and pay for everything. You don't need to pay your bills by sending a check in the mail. You can pay it online. You know, there's if you want a receipt, they don't print it out anymore. You can have it emailed to you. So there's a new trend of everything becoming more and more digital, and maybe there's a new trend of only carrying very minimal things in your pocket, like just this coin, and paying everything else online. So that's the future of money, as the people that I talked to said.
So the future of money may not be the coin, but it definitely or most likely will be something digital in nature. We don't exactly know what that shape looks like just yet.
Just yet, exactly. And it seems like the future of money is going away from these big credit card companies. That there's a lot of these smaller corporations that are giving businesses the opportunity to pay their bills or exchange money between businesses or exchange money with the banks through smaller digital means that don't necessarily cost as much money as a big credit card company will provide. So I think what's great about this startup culture that you're seeing throughout the entire United States, it's not just here where I am in Washington, but it's in Chicago right there or Des Moines, Iowa, or I'm sure in Wisconsin, of these small companies who are finding creative solutions that kind of buck the way things have gone through for many years. And so a lot of creative things are popping up, at least especially the coin.
Now, when you talk about a small company, though, a small startup maybe based in Des Moines or Chicago or someplace like that, and they're going sort of, you know, head-to-head with credit card companies who are not particularly small and have lots of resources, are most of these startups just going to fall by the wayside? I mean, you know, it takes money to get something like the coin out there and into some sort of wide distribution.
That's exactly right. And they are so small, they don't have the money. And so coin right now is going out into the internet, you know, and they're asking people for money. They're looking to raise $50,000 right now. And, you know, if it's just six guys in some San Francisco office, you know, they can't afford that kind of capital. So many of these startups rely on crowdfunding, and it relies on, you know, people like you and me who, you know, just could donate a little bit of money, or maybe some big rich investor like Mark Cuban, you know, the owner of the Mavericks. And that's how startups like PayPal got started, or there's a new one in Washington and other places in the East Coast called Uber, and then you can order a taxi on your phone. It's quite the service that we use out here. But it takes crowdfunding. It takes small donations from people because they can't, you know, frankly afford to do it otherwise. The credit card companies have just way too much money.
And you know, another thing that you mentioned Uber, and it reminds me that a lot of these ideas seem awfully abstract until you actually use them. You mm-hmm. know, you talk about the Uber concept and like, oh, you use it to get a cab or a shared ride somehow, and then you
right.
use it and you're like, well, now that changes things.
It is, and it's I had the same reaction. You know, I saw this, I'm like, oh, this isn't going to last. You know, this won't work. And now I find that on weekends I'm relying heavily on this service. And I guess that idea goes even further. You think about, you're at the Apple store and someone walks up to you with their iPad and you just swipe your credit card on the iPad and you have paid for all of your belongings without going up to a desk, and they email your receipt right there. I mean, that sort of concept of paying on a credit on an iPad, or going to a food truck, you know, in the middle of town and just paying right there without a credit card machine or anything, and it's done. I mean, that was crazy 2 years ago. So if you think about how much technology in terms of paying for things has progressed over the last couple of years, you can only imagine where it's going to go in the next couple of years. I mean, it's exciting to think about, just because, you know, the world is fundamentally changing in this respect, and I think that's quite exciting.
Now, we've been talking about this kind of from the consumer vantage point, but what about a business, a small business like a food truck, or maybe a large business like a, you know, department store chain of some kind? Mm-hmm. What's in it for them to come up, you know, to have to deal with yet another way to pay for something?
I think that it's more convenient for them. I mean, if you give stores and food trucks an easier way of going around, you know, the red tape, I think that's brilliant. I mean, the square, this is what I was talking about. It's mm-hmm. it's called the Square Reader. It's the size of a quarter, and it attaches to your iPod or iPad, and you can swipe someone's information, and it deposits directly into your bank account. And if you can do that without having to carry around the big bulky credit card machine and find an internet connection, I mean, I think that makes your business profoundly more efficient. I think it gives, in turn, the customers or the consumers a better business too, or a better experience as well, because it's just easier for them to check out, and you don't spend as much time checking customers out. You can get that quickly.
And, you know, the thing about making things easier, though, is you also make, I think, that information more accessible when it's digital. And so for those folks who, you know, who might want to take that information for some sort of nefarious purpose, mm-hmm. Doesn't that put your information more at risk than it may have been?
That's the elephant in the room here. So, you know, the coin, while it does notify you that you're walking away and you're leaving it there,
mm-hmm.
your information is still, you know, on this card. You know, people can still access it if they steal it. You know, Bluetooth is not the most secure connection. You know, people can
exactly.
tap into that Bluetooth connection. And, you know, with any of these technologies, I mean, when I went home for Thanksgiving and I talked to my dad about this, you know, when you talk about these small companies, you know, they're very small companies. They might not have the security infrastructure that a credit card company might have. You know, so there might not be the necessary steps that you need to take in order to make sure that your information is as secure as possible. So that's obviously the biggest risk here, is that they might not, while it's a great concept and they have a nice presentation, you know, maybe their security is not as tested, because Coin is a company that's been around for 6 months, and it's going to be probably a year old by the time their product comes out. And, you know, that might be disconcerting to some people.
So what do you think? In 5 years, 10 years, we'll be looking back at what used to be paper money and coins?
Yeah, I think that I think that we will have, you know, currency, but I don't think that people will carry as much of it around. Just me personally, I mean, I don't carry, I rarely carry cash on me. And I think that people will find more and more ways of paying through their cell phone, and that will become more and more secure. I think in a few years' time, coin might be the norm, or there might be some new technology that makes the coin irrelevant. You know, it's just the nature of technology.
It sure is. Well, Matt, thanks so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me on.
Matt Vasilogambros is a staff correspondent at the National Journal, and we've got a link to his piece if you'd like to read about it. It's called "Cash is Dead. Are Credit Cards Next?" And you will find that on the Central Time Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll be talking with a guest who says pride in Milwaukee is growing, but the city needs to have a community conversation about including more people in the city's future plans.
We'll also talk with an author who says the future of America will be more diverse, and the era of the angry white man ultimately will be coming to an end.
And while it might be tempting to surprise a loved one with a cute puppy or kitty this holiday season, think twice before you do it.
That's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.
Coming up after the news, from Jay-Z to Al Gore, we'll be talking about the growing trend of going vegan in the U.S. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.